This program provides education, not advice. Sponsors pay a fee for endorsements and interviews. See the truthayf.com disclosure page for details.
This is where technology, innovation, and personal finance come together.
This is The Truth About Your Future with Rick Edelman.
How should you think about Bitcoin? Turn to a specialist. For 6 years, Bitwise has been helping investors access crypto. Bitwise manages the world's largest crypto index fund. They also offer 6 crypto ETFs. You get cutting-edge insights, expert Bitcoin research, and a nationwide team to help. Bitwise helps investors and advisors navigate crypto with confidence. Partner with a specialist. Look for ETFs backed by Bitwise. Bitwiseinvestments.com. Carefully consider the extreme risks associated with crypto before investing.
It's Friday, April 12th. On today's show, the Bitcoin halving is coming next week. And here's the details about it. Plus, a conversation with a millennial. Well, April 16th is the projected date right now. That's next week. April 16th, Bitcoin's block mining reward is going to be cut in half. This Bitcoin halving occurs every 4 years, and it is a hugely anticipated event within the crypto community. This is not the first time. It's actually the fourth time that Bitcoin has experienced a halving. Here's how it works. According to the computer code that was written to create Bitcoin back in 2009, the number of Bitcoins that gets produced every 10 minutes gets cut in half every 4 years. When Bitcoin was first launched in 2009, every 10 minutes, more Bitcoins comes onto the marketplace. I'm not going to bother wasting your time explaining how those block rewards are created and the computer algorithm that makes it so. All you really need to know for practical purposes is that roughly every 10 minutes, back in 2009, 50 new Bitcoins became available on the marketplace. It's kind of like mining for gold. Just imagine that every 10 minutes, an ounce of gold gets pulled out of the ground. Not going to bother going into details about how people find the gold or the equipment they use to do it or the expenses they incur in getting it done and what do they do with the gold once they find it. All those are important details for sure. But all you really need to know is that every 10 minutes, they pull an ounce of gold out of the ground. That's my analogy. Similar to Bitcoin, every 10 minutes, 50 new Bitcoins are produced. That was back in 2009. But the computer algorithm and software that was originally created, which is still in place today regarding Bitcoin, said that roughly every 4 years, the number of Bitcoins that are produced every 10 minutes gets cut in half. So in 2012 was the first Bitcoin halving. And suddenly, instead of getting 50 new Bitcoins every 10 minutes, you only get 25 Bitcoins produced every 10 minutes. That was followed by another Bitcoin halving in 2016. The number of Bitcoins produced fell from 25 to 12.5. That was cut again in 2020 to 6.25. And next week, on April 16th, or give or take a day, the number of coins being produced every 10 minutes will be cut from 6.25 to 3.125. Now, whenever this happens, everybody in the crypto community asks a very basic question. What does this mean for the miners? In other words, if you're mining for gold and you know that every 10 minutes you're pulling an ounce of gold out of the ground, but suddenly, for reasons we're not going to get into, you're now going to pull not an ounce of gold out of the ground, but half an ounce of gold out of the ground. You've got to ask yourself, what's the implication on the gold miners? I mean, we all know that there's only one reason people are mining for gold. It's because gold is valuable. That the ounce of gold, we'll call it $2,000 an ounce, that's pretty terrific. You spend a lot of time and effort and spend a lot of money to go find that gold, and you're rewarded every time you pull gold out of the ground. If you're pulling an ounce out every 10 minutes, you make $2,000. But suddenly, for some inextricable reason, you're not pulling an ounce out. You're only pulling out half an ounce. That means you're not pulling out $2,000 worth of gold. You're only pulling out $1,000 worth of gold. Your profit, your revenues just got cut in half. But the cost of your operation didn't get cut. You're still spending the same amount of time and effort and money to find and mine that gold, but your profit of doing so just got cut in half. That's what's happening with Bitcoin. You were receiving 6.25 Bitcoins every 10 minutes. Now you're only getting 3.125. So the question people are asking is, what does this mean for the Bitcoin miners? What's this doing to their profitability? And it is because of this scenario that there has been an interesting observation regarding the price of Bitcoin. Since the number of Bitcoins produced is getting cut in half, in order to protect the profits of the miners, the price of Bitcoin has doubled. In other words, if you were getting 1 ounce of gold at $2,000, and now you're only getting half an ounce of gold, well, then that half ounce needs to be $2,000, which means a full ounce is now $4,000. And that is what has happened to Bitcoin after every halving in Bitcoin's history. And for this reason, a lot of people have been getting excited and enthused about the coming halving, which is now set to occur next week. And in anticipation of the halving, the price of Bitcoin has already been rising on the attitude that we don't have to wait for the halving to occur for Bitcoin's price to go up. We're going to buy Bitcoin now, knowing the price will rise later. And many argue this is a contributing factor to Bitcoin's recent price increase. It's up 60% year to date. And in fact, if you look at the historical performance of Bitcoin, you would discover that in the months prior to the halving and the months following the halving, Bitcoin's price rises dramatically. Sometimes in the past, thousands of percent in a single year. So there's a lot of excitement in the crypto community about this. And this is one of the reasons people argue that the price of Bitcoin has been rising. We also have enjoyed the fact that we now have Bitcoin ETFs on the market for the first time ever, making Bitcoin more widely available to investors via financial advisors. And the billions of dollars of inflows have also contributed to the price increase. So we've had two happy circumstances in 2024 regarding Bitcoin: the availability of the new ETFs and the widely anticipated Bitcoin halving, which only occurs every 4 years, and now coming this coming week. But before you get too excited, you have to keep two facts in mind about whether or not the upcoming halving is truly going to create the big price appreciation that everybody's calling for. Number one, and perhaps this is the most important statement, past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Merely because Bitcoin's price rose in the prior halvings doesn't necessarily mean that it will with this halving. And here is a big reason why it might not. It has to do with the halvings themselves. You see, back in 2009, if you were getting 50 Bitcoins every 10 minutes, you have to remember that at the moment in 2009, Bitcoin was brand new. So if you suddenly produced 50 Bitcoins every 10 minutes, pretty soon you had dozens, hundreds, thousands, then tens of thousands of Bitcoins. And when the first halving occurred in 2012 and the mining reward was cut from 50 Bitcoins to 25, that was a huge implication, a massive reduction in mining reward from 50 to 25 at a time when there were relatively few Bitcoins available in the marketplace. But you fast forward now to 2024. At this point, 95% of all the Bitcoins that will ever be mined already have been mined. They're already in the marketplace. And we aren't producing 50 every 10 minutes. We're only producing 6 and change. And starting next week, 3.125. In other words, the cut from 6 to 3 isn't nearly as significant as cutting from 50 to 25, especially when you consider that of the 21 million Bitcoins that will ever be mined, 19 million of them already have been. So is the halving as big a deal today as it was in the past? This is an open question, and we don't know the answer. Many people in the crypto community continue to believe that, yes, it is going to be an issue. It continues to be an issue because the Bitcoin miners are still dependent on mining new Bitcoins for their profitability. And bottom line is, Their profits are getting cut in half because the number of Bitcoins they're mining is getting cut in half. That fact alone trumps everything else and is why you're going to see a doubling in Bitcoin's price. It's hard to refute the logic. My point is simple. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results, and the number of Bitcoins being mined on a 10-minute basis is only 3 1/8, whereas it used to be 50 or 25. And coming up on the show, in 60 seconds, a conversation with a millennial.
The Truth About Your Future with Rick Edelman is brought to you by Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes. Buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematicinvesting.
Support for Rick Edelman's podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Meet Carmen, an everyday person who likes working in the garden, hosting dinner parties with friends, and listening to live music. She also participates in progress by investing in a fund that supports innovative ideas. Invesco QQQ ETF allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100, so you don't have to be an engineer to help push progress forward. Anyone can become an agent of innovation. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETFs risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 Index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, carefully read and consider fund investment objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in prospectus at Invesco.com. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
You're listening to The Truth About Your Future. Joining me on the program right now is Mary Dawson. Hello, Mary.
Hey, Rick. How are you?
So what are you doing here?
I am here to talk to you about securing your future.
Why am I allowing you to do that with me?
Because I'm your favorite neighbor and best friend.
You told my producer that when he asked for your bio, you told him that your bio predominantly consists of A, bothering Rick at family dinners.
Yes.
And B, keeping Rick up to date on all the latest pop culture news and trends.
All accurate. How do you think we got here today?
So just for context, how old are you, Mary?
26.
26 years old. So, okay. So we could double your age and you would still be 10 years younger than me. So, okay. So what do you want to talk about?
Well, of course, the one and only Taylor Swift and how she's saving the U.S. economy. I know that's one of your favorite topics. Well, also maybe diving into securing your future in your 20s and kind of creating a foundation now to set yourself up for success.
So let's talk about Taylor Swift, first of all. And yes, I do know who Taylor Swift is.
I'm proud.
But no, I have not been to a Taylor Swift concert. I presume you have.
Not a great financial decision to buy those tickets, but don't stress. I am going again in Miami and I've already been to one.
The first concert you went to was where?
Vegas.
So you flew from Virginia to Las Vegas to go see Taylor Swift in concert. How much did that event cost you?
I don't want to say.
Well, I know you don't want to say, but you're here on the podcast and you're going to answer my questions. So,
okay. Our tickets we got with the code. So Ticketmaster sends out pre-sale codes, and if you get them, you can get them at normal price. So for that, we were pretty good. Our tickets were about $200. So not bad for our Taylor Swift tickets.
So how much was the airfare?
I think it was like 600.
And how many days did you stay in Vegas?
3 nights.
And how much was the hotel?
I believe it was around $300 to $400 a night.
So we're talking about $1,000 for the hotel, $600 for the airfare. How much did you spend on, entertainment and food?
I would say ranged from probably $200 a night, I'm guessing, from drinks and dinner.
So we're going to call it, since you think it's 200, I'm going to call it 400. So we're going to call that an easy $1,000 over the 3 nights. And did you buy any swag, any merch from Taylor Swift when you went to the show? How much?
I got a sweatshirt, I got a t-shirt, so, and I got my friend a t-shirt, so probably walk away 150, $200 merch.
So a couple hundred bucks there. So all told, it looks like we're at $2,000 plus. And you're going again to see her where?
Miami.
So you'll spend $1,500, $1,000 to $1,500 going to Miami to see Taylor a second time. And this is being known as Swiftonomics, you told me.
Yes.
So I checked it out. And let me just share with you some statistics that perhaps you know, but I suspect many of the listeners of this podcast, since they are closer to my age than yours, may not be aware of.
That's why I'm here. I'm here to educate, get bring some pop culture trends.
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate it. Forbes says that Taylor Swift is now the second richest self-made woman in U.S. music history. She has conducted 140 concerts in 2023 and will have by the end of 2024. 140 concerts, 54,000 fans attending each concert on average at an average ticket price of $254. Now, as we know, fans themselves are spending a lot more. That average ticket price is when you go through Ticketmaster. These shows are grossing $13 million apiece. That's a grand total of $300 million that Taylor Swift is generating from ticket sales alone, plus another $1.8 billion in sponsorships and merchandise sales. One study says that in Colorado alone, when Taylor Swift did two concerts in Denver, the state's GDP rose $140 million. The Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia says that Taylor Swift's tour stimulated travel and tourism in the Northeast region when she was there last May. It produced the strongest month for hotel revenue in the city since the pandemic. Las Vegas said the same thing. Chicago says they set a record for occupied hotel rooms when she was there with a 97% occupancy. $4.6 billion in consumer spending injected into the economy. World of economics is now Swiftonomics. And your point to all of this is,
She's saving the US economy.
as opposed to Joe Biden saving the US economy, what else do you want to talk about?
I have a bunch of people that always ask me, and I don't know why they ask me, is always, what's a good credit card? What credit card should you be getting? And I'm like, there is so much information out there. There's credit card information overload.
So these are friends of yours, people in your cohort in your mid-20s asking you for financial advice.
I don't know why. I don't know why. It's not that I don't ask me. So I'm asking you so I can tell them. But
Okay.
there's so much information out there being like, should I get one based off what airline I use? Should I get one based off if I get free pre-check? Should I get one based off that they give me free Uber Eats? But I don't think that's really what we should be looking for.
How many credit cards do you have, Mary?
I have two.
And how did you choose them?
First one was what I got when I was a teenager, or it was a USA card to kind of start creating my credit score. And the second one was a Marriott Bonvoy card that my dad referred me to because he wanted the free referral points. And the way they set it up was that my allowance was through that credit card. So they maxed it at like a certain number. I wasn't able to spend over. And that's how, and they would pay it off each month so they would start building my credit score.
So your parents transferred your allowance into the card instead of giving you the cash. Do you ever get cash from anybody?
No, but I always do carry cash.
Why?
Because you never know if you need it.
What might you need it for?
Sometimes it's like you go to get gas and the gas pump's credit card's not working and you need cash. I always think it's important to at least just have $50 on you for emergencies.
That's, I assume, an uncommon trait among friends of yours.
Yes. They're always like, I'll just Venmo.
Venmo versus PayPal?
Yes, always Venmo.
Why?
Don't know why. To be completely honest, I do not know why.
Do you have a PayPal account?
Nope.
You know they're both owned by the same company.
I did not.
So let's go back to the credit card conversation. How do you choose a credit card? It is entirely depending on your spending habits. Some cards have a low annual fee or even zero, where you have the card, you use the card at no cost, and they charge you interest for the balances that you accumulate that you do not pay off at the end of the month. Other cards have a very high annual fee, but the interest rate is much lower. So it really depends on the way you use the card. Here's the ideal way. The ideal perfect way of using a credit card is that you get a card that is free. There's no annual fee. You use the card for purchases. And as soon as the bill shows up at the end of the month, you pay the bill in full. You don't make the minimum payment or a partial payment. You pay it off in full. By doing so, within the grace period of the bill itself, meaning within just several days, you are not going to incur any interest expense. This, in other words, gives you free use of the card. You're not paying an annual fee and you're not paying any interest. That's the best way to do it. Most people don't do that. Most people, instead of paying the bill in full, they make the minimum payment required. In fact, if you notice on the credit card bill, the minimum payment required is a very big number on the page. The total amount owed is a much smaller number and harder to find because the credit card company doesn't want you to pay the bill off in full. They want you to make the minimum payment so they can charge you interest. And the interest is going to be 15, 18, 24%, almost as high as 30%, just below 29.9% is going to be the maximum interest a credit card charges. When you go beyond that, you get into usury laws that gets them in trouble with the federal government. So some of these cards are going to charge 25 to 29% in interest, and that's how they make their money. So you don't want to incur that massive amount of interest. So you should, bottom line is, not use a credit card unless you know you can afford to pay it off at the end of the month. Too often people are not doing that because studies have shown that when people make purchases with a credit card, they spend more than if they're using cash. Partly because they're limited by the amount of cash in their pocket. You've got $50, your friends have less. Also because cash feels like real money. Plastic is just a piece of plastic. It doesn't really feel like you're spending anything. And people forget by the 20th of the month that they had already used the credit card 10 times earlier in the month, and they don't realize what the current balance is that they've racked up because they've gone from store to store and bar to bar and restaurant to restaurant, and they are shocked at the end of the month when the bill shows up as to what the total balance is on the card. And even if they wanted to pay it off in full, they can't afford to. Forcing them to carry a balance into the next month, and all of a sudden they're now paying interest. And if they don't pay the bill off by the end of the second month, now they're going to be paying interest on the interest. And it becomes a downward spiral to debt. And right now, $1.2 trillion in total credit card debt in this country, exceeded only by student loan debt and mortgage debt. So this is a big deal and why your friends need to pay really close attention to how they're doing this. But what I just described is the ideal. Zero card cost and zero interest expense because you're paying it off in full every month. Couple of other pieces of fine print, Mary, you need to be aware of. Number one is that cards offer, in many cases, some array of benefits. They'll give you discounts on travel. They'll give you access to a lounge at an airport. They will give you cash back. You can use the cash back in a restaurant or in a supermarket or Uber Eats, as you suggested, et cetera. So what you have to decide are two things. What's the percentage of the cash back? Obviously, the bigger percentage you get back, the better. It's like a rebate or a discount on your purchase. But more specifically, what are the terms and conditions of the cash back? In other words, some cards will give you a 5% cash back, but only on gasoline. Well, if you don't drive very much, that's not really of huge value. If you aren't using Uber Eats, a cash back on Uber Eats does you no good at all. So you want to make sure that the cash back program is something you'll truly use and use often. That's the first point. The second point is the comment you made earlier that you got a credit card at age 16 in order to build your credit. That's a really good idea to build a credit record. When you go to buy a car, most people can't afford to pay cash. They're going to get a car loan.
When you go to rent an apartment, the landlord isn't going to rent to you unless you have demonstrated a history of paying your bills on time. If you go to buy a house, you're certainly going to need to get a mortgage. And similarly, you're going to have to demonstrate credit worthiness. So building a credit record is really important. But you have to recognize something really important. If you get a credit card, charge items, and then pay it off at the end of the month, and do that consistently, you're not building a credit record. You're building a payment record. That's good. That's helpful. Companies want to know that you have a history of paying your bills on time. But what they really want to know is that you pay your debts on time. So if you use the credit card and pay it off in full every month and you're never paying interest, you're never actually borrowing money. You're not actually building a credit record, which means it's of limited utility in proving to future potential lenders, like car companies or home sellers, that you are trustworthy when it comes to borrowing money, because the use of a credit card isn't really borrowing. Debit cards have the same problem. A debit card isn't a loan either. You're just actually debiting money from your own bank account. You're not borrowing from anyone. So you're not really using, you're not really generating any credit history by using a debit card. It's convenient, it's safer than carrying cash, but it doesn't really solve the problem. So what you might want to do, and this is counterintuitive, is actually go to a bank and ask for a loan of $2,000 that will be repaid over 1 or 2 years, that will cost you 5 or 10% in interest. Bank loans are cheaper than credit card loans. And knowing that you are actually willfully incurring an interest debt, you're doing so in order to build a true credit record. By paying off that bank debt on schedule every month for 12 months or 24 months, you'll be demonstrating to the credit industry that you are mature and responsible, and that you incur debt, but then you pay them off. You take the $2,000 that you borrow from the bank, put it back in the bank, earning 5%. You'll lose money on the deal, not very much.
Or you borrow the $2,000 and go to the Taylor Swift concert.
Or you could do something incredibly stupid and foolish and spend the money on a Taylor Swift concert. It's better than using your credit card to do it. I'll give you that.
Okay.
So that's what you should tell your friends. They need to pay attention to whether they're going to pay the balance off in full. If so, they don't care what the interest rate is the bank charges, they'll never pay it. They should go for a free credit card. On the other hand, if they're going to carry a balance month to month, they should seek a credit card with as low an interest rate as possible. And who cares what the annual fee is? That'll be trivial in comparison.
So is there any truth to what they always say, that your ratio of how much...
There are lots of ratios. There is a debt to income ratio that is really important. What a creditor is going to look at, if you're looking to borrow money to get a car loan, or if you're looking to borrow money to get a home loan, the lender is going to take a look at your total income, and they're going to take a look at your total outstanding debts. And that creates a ratio. For example, let's say that you have $100,000 in income, and this car is $40,000 that you're buying, and that is a ratio, 100,000 to 40,000, that gives you a 5-to-2 ratio. That number is something they pay a lot of attention to. In other words, everybody pretty much acknowledges, I'm willing to lend you money, it's pretty good likelihood you'll pay me back, but if I lend you so much money, it'll overwhelm you and you won't be able to pay it back. So I only want to lend you as much as you can afford to repay. So how much money you already owe other people matters as I'm looking to give you a loan. So the mortgage lender wants to know about your car loan and your student loan and your credit card loan, because the more you owe to all of them, the less the mortgage lender is going to be willing to give you. So you do want to demonstrate that you have had debts, you have paid them off, you have current debts, and you are current with your bills. But you don't want to have so much total balance owed to all of your debts that it eliminates your ability to get yet another debt. It could interfere with your ability to buy a car or to buy a house. So within all of that, a couple of other huge rules apply. You must always make the monthly payment on time. You must never be late. You must never miss a payment or skip a payment. And you must never, ever bounce a check.
What if you overpay? Sometimes they always say, like, if you pay more and pay that your debt down faster, that sometimes that could hurt. Is that just a rumor?
It can hurt because the lender is in business to provide loans to people. And they are building a business model on how much money they're lending, the interest rate they're charging, what the minimum payments are per month, and how much they're going to be receiving on a monthly basis. If you screw up their model by prepaying the loan, they're not going to be earning as much interest as they thought. The loan isn't going to last as long. They're going to end up with more cash available to relend than they were anticipating. You can kind of mess up their business model, and they will ding you for that. If you are making a promise, say with a car loan, that you are going to have monthly payments for 5 months or for 5 years at $500 a month, they want you to make the payments of $500 a month for 5 years. They don't want you to prepay it. Same thing with a mortgage loan. If you have a 30-year mortgage, they want you to make payments for 30 years. They know that the loan won't really last that long. You'll likely sell the house, and when you do, you pay it off. But they really don't like the idea of prepayments to a big degree, and they could generate an adverse impact on your credit record. Doesn't always happen. The degree to which it happens may not have a huge impact on your credit score. I wouldn't be terribly worried about it. At the end of the day, if you're making a series of payments to a high interest loan, pay it off to get rid of that high interest. That's a better deal than tolerating it in order to avoid the potential ding for prepayment.
So is there something like when you were my age that you wish you did like a $2,000 loan right now to secure, like start creating a higher credit score? Or is there something else that you wish you did today?
There were a lot of mistakes that I made at your age. Let me ramble off several. Not contributing to my employer's retirement plan to the maximum that I was permitted pre-tax. You have a 401k where you work?
Yes.
And you're contributing to it?
Yes, max amount.
The maximum amount that they allow or the maximum amount pre-tax?
Maximum amount allowed pre-tax.
So that's a great approach. So you should be contributing the maximum to your retirement plan at work, regardless of the employer match. That's free money. That's totally separate. By you contributing the maximum pre-tax, you will hit the full matching contribution they offer, because what you contribute will always be bigger than what they do. The mistake that I find people making, the mistake I made when I was your age, is that I didn't contribute the maximum that I was allowed. And as a result, I wasn't accumulating as much wealth at an early age as I could have been. So contribute the maximum pre-tax. And the reason I emphasize pre-tax is that if you contribute more than that, which you are allowed to do in many cases, you're not getting any particular tax benefit for doing so, and therefore there's not a really particular incentive or motivation for doing your saving inside the 401k. You might as well do it elsewhere where you don't have the rules and restrictions of the employer plan. So contributing 100% of your availability in a pre-tax account is great. Where did you invest the money? Once you put the money into the plan, what investment options did you pick?
It's a bunch of different funds. I just picked the classic S&P 500 mutual fund.
100% into the S&P 500.
50 in the S&P, and then I did 50 in the the European S&P market fund.
So a foreign stock fund.
Yes.
So 100% of the money, however, is going into stocks.
Yes.
That, again, is perfect. Too often what we find is that people choose other investment options, such as bonds or a fixed account or a money market account, which are guaranteed in many cases. And that's what people focus on, is the guarantee. They, however, don't realize that they are earning, as a result, a far lower rate of return over the course of their career than what they're likely to get from stocks. So choosing stock funds, 100% of your contributions makes a perfect amount of sense for somebody your age, since you're not going to touch the money for 40 plus years. So that makes a great deal of sense as well. So those were a couple of mistakes I made. I didn't contribute the maximum. And then I made the worst mistake of all. After I left my first job, which I got straight out of college, 2 years later, left that job, had some money in the retirement plan at work, and they said to me upon my last day there, the classic question, what do you want us to do with the money in your retirement plan? I said, what are my options? And they said, well, you can leave it here, or you can move it to your next employer, or we can just cut you a check and you can have the cash. And I said, well, how much cash is it? And they said, about $800. And I said, sold. And I took the cash, paid taxes plus a 10% penalty. So I lost almost half of it to taxes, and then spent the money on, I have no idea what, probably my generation's version of Taylor Swift t-shirts. So the big mistake I made is that I didn't save early enough. I didn't save as much as I could have. I didn't focus on the long term, and I squandered probably 10 years worth of accumulated savings and compound growth that I wish I hadn't done. And I think it's fair to say that just about everybody who's my age would have the same lament and regret, and would strongly encourage their children and grandchildren not to make that same mistake. So I'm really glad you've avoided it. How is it you avoided that, though, Mary? You're
so many family dinners with you that have you've engraved it in my mind.
So was it until those dinners you were not contributing at all to your future retirement savings?
No, I would say, well.
So you didn't get any.
How long have we known each other now? Have we moved 10 years?
Yeah, you were barely in high school, I think, when we first met. So you didn't, in K through 12, you didn't have any school teachers teaching you about money?
No.
Does the subject of money and savings and investing come up with your friends?
Not really. I think it's a sticky topic. Makes people, I don't think a lot of people like to talk about it.
So people are intimidated by a subject that they don't know much about. Are they afraid that they're not doing as well as their friends?
It's more about like, oh, what are we doing tonight? What bar are we going to?
So you'd rather focus on what are we doing this weekend as opposed to what are we doing in 50 years?
Exactly. And I don't think it's a conversation that people bring up, which then gets them in trouble in the next 10 years.
And is it partly surrounded by the fact that, hey, you're in your 20s, you got plenty of time to deal with this later?
I think that's a mindset that people have.
And how about the fact that you're only in your 20s, you're new in your career, you're doing well, but you're not doing as well as you will be doing 20 years from now. You're going to be making a lot more money in the future, and you'll have a lot more capability of saving then. So we'll worry about it later. Is that a pretty much common attitude?
I would say so.
Do you think it's a valid attitude?
It can get you in trouble, I would say, because today, doing what you can do right now can really set you apart in the future by having it compound in your early 20s and constantly accruing more on top of what you already accrued can really help you in the future.
Well, I can imagine that if you're at a bar with your friends and you're drinking away and having a great time, and suddenly you start talking about the subject of money and the need to eliminate debt, reduce debt, increase savings.
It is a definitely good bar conversation.
Well, I don't know, because how enticing would that be to go buy another margarita? I mean, at $15. Is that what margaritas cost today? How much?
It's probably around $15.
So how can I can see that these conversations are incompatible. How can we talk about the desire to reduce student loan debt and pay off other debts and increase savings, but let's order another beer?
You got me there.
So which is why I think you're not having the conversation about money very often.
No.
By the same notion, I don't think you're going to be talking about how to lose weight while in a restaurant eating nachos.
Definitely not.
Yeah. Okay. And you're certainly not going to be talking about how to improve your credit record while shopping at Nordstrom's.
100% not.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you need to have an elimination of cognitive dissonance where you are now paying attention to money on an ongoing, persistent basis, where it is guiding the decision-making process in all aspects of your daily life, from going to Starbucks to paying $8 for a cup of coffee.
But did you see me there this morning?
How often do you go to Starbucks?
I don't want to answer that question.
Come on, how often do you go to Starbucks?
Probably 3 times a week. at least.
Which means five times a week. And how much do you spend each time you go?
Like $5.
But there's more to life than money, isn't there?
Yes.
And this is one of the big concerns that that your generation has raised about my generation. My generation tends to talk about the importance of saving and don't spend money frivolously. And we'll tease you and argue with you about your Taylor Swift concert twice. But on the other hand, your generation will respond by saying there's more to life than money. And why delay pleasure and benefit throughout an entire life merely to accumulate wealth by the time I'm in my 70s, where I'll be old and infirm and unable to enjoy myself? Why delay that round the world cruise into my 70s when I can enjoy that in my 20s and 30s? That spending money isn't necessarily bad if it's enriching and fulfilling as part of a broad life. It's the whole work-life balance conversation that my generation has failed miserably at, because there is no work-life balance. There is only work. There is no life balance. Your generation insists on working from home because it affords a life balance to a much greater degree than commuting 2 hours into the city and spending a gazillion dollars on those commuting expenses, parking, lunch at the office, and dry cleaning. So I think you're right. I think your generation is right about that fact. I'm not going to beat you up too badly about spending $2,000 going to see Taylor Swift twice. What I will, however, complain about is when that's all that your generation is doing, that you are not also saving for your future. You're not also setting aside cash reserves. You're not also creating a financial plan and thinking ahead to the future, contemplating marriage, the cost of children, owning a home, and other elements that are a natural part of life as an adult in an affluent society. So my point is simply that you don't need to create a budget. You don't need to focus too heavily on how you spend money, provided you save first. Once you are saving the proper amount of money to achieve your future financial goals, you can then spend the rest of your money however you want, completely guilt-free. Does that make sense?
How do you decide at what percentage is what you need to be saving for your future goals? Because your goals can constantly change.
That's why you hire a financial advisor.
At what point in your life do you think you should get one?
Yesterday.
Yesterday, okay.
When should you go to a doctor?
Yesterday.
Right? The sooner you begin, the better off you'll be.
Mm-hmm.
All right, final point. You said you wanted to talk to me about girl math.
Oh, man. Have you heard of it?
Vaguely. So what is girl math?
It's basically just three common principles put together to get you girl math. So cost per wear, sunk cost, and then prospective cost. But the idea is basically, so I bought those Taylor Swift tickets 6 months ago. Okay. The day of the concert, that cost in my head, it's gone. I don't remember it. That was 6 months ago. It was a sunk cost. That outfit I bought for it, well, I'm going to wear it to concert. Well, I have an event the next week. I'll probably wear it again there and maybe some other time. So if I'm going to get three wears out of it, it's definitely worth its cost. And then, perspective cost of it, it was worth it.
So you're talking about behavioral finance. Actually. So let me ask you a question. You go into a department store, you're looking at a dress, it is $800, but it is on sale for $500. If you were to buy it,
yes,
would you go home and say to your girlfriends that you paid $500 or that you saved $300?
You'd probably say I saved $300. That's girl math for you.
It's called mental accounting, where you are rationalizing and justifying the expense. In the case of I'm going to wear this dress three times, not just once, you're amortizing it in an effort to say, well, it was a $300 dress, but since I wore it three times, it was only $100 each. So why do they call it girl math? That would just strike me as condescending, insulting, and incredibly sexist.
It can be.
Mary Dawson, whose claim to fame on her resume is bothering Rick at family dinners.
Yes.
Thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time and a lot of fun. I hope you did too.
Support for Rick Edelman's podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. What do all the greatest innovations have in common? Agents, people who participate in progress by supporting cutting-edge ideas.
Invesco QQQ is a fund that allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100 all in one fund. So you don't have to be an inventor to help create what's next to come. Anyone can become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETFs' risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 Index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, carefully read and consider fund investment objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in prospectus at Invesco.com. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
So, the halving is coming up. It's going to be an exciting day for crypto, and 2024 is expected to be a continuing exciting year for it as well. It's the Bitcoin halving. It's coming next week.
How do advances in science, technology, and medicine translate into investment opportunity? Listen and learn.
This is the truth about your future with Rick Edelman.